I'm not entirely sure why Father Thomas picked this topic, but I imagine that it is the combination of being perhaps the most familiar chemical to us. When we think about molecules, water, I think, is one of those that we encounter every day. We may or may not think about it as a chemical, but as a substance is something we are really familiar with. So that's good. You know, we all have this anchoring point in some sense, since I know from experience that chemistry tends to not be the favorite subject of people who are not chemists. So it's good to have this anchoring point that we can start out from together. But I imagine that another reason is that water is also pretty weird. It is not, I mean, it might for us be a normal chemical in some sense, but it is not one that follows the patterns of other molecules that we know in any sort of readily discernible way. So we'll get into that a little bit, what it is that makes water weird. And I think the final thing is that it's easy to forget that water, we no longer live in an Aristotelian universe where things have been here forever. You know, water has to come from somewhere. And it did come from somewhere, and it's actually pretty cool where it came from. I'm not entirely sure if Father Thomas knew how cool it was when he tasked me to do this, but we will go through and talk about where our water actually comes from. But I want to start with, and even what I would imagine sort of a fourth motivation, which is that water is also, you know, one of those molecules that really connects chemistry and biology. That it is, there is a reason that you cannot go very long without water. As an organism. And it is not specific to us humans. Wherever we look at cells, you know, the building blocks of any living thing here on Earth, they depend on water in a multitude of ways. So I have listed some here, but in some sense, the important thing is that there are, you know, the number of things listed. You don't necessarily need to read everything. So just give a few examples. So how proteins and DNA fold, so the very building blocks of sort of information and function in your cell. So they have to fold in specific ways to have the functionality that, you know, that makes our cells work the way they do. Water is an important part of that folding. You need to get nutrients from one part of the cell to another or between cells. That requires water. Many chemical reactions either consume or produce water as a part of the reaction itself. Most chemical reactions in your body only function in a very narrow temperature interval. So your chemistry, the chemistry in our cells, is extremely well tuned. Water, because of its properties, is just really good at regulating temperature and allowing you to stay in that very narrow temperature range. Which is why one of the symptoms of, you know, you not having been drinking enough water is going to be overheating. Like you need water to regulate temperature. And finally, many of the chemical reactions in your cells, they produce waste, and that needs to be transported away or you will poison the cells. And that too requires water. So there are many, water has a range of functionality when it comes to living things. Now, going back one step, sort of the origins of life here on Earth, we also think that water, while it was for sure necessary for life here on Earth, we'll get to in a minute if it's sort of necessary always. Now, the great importance of water, sort of this prebiotic stage, comes from that water is sort of an ideal place for chemicals to meet. Now, if you're going to have chemical reactions happening, you need to have some medium where molecules, ions, different kinds of building blocks can come together. And water is just very good at dissolving many different kinds of substances in it and therefore enable this very rich chemistry. Now, there are some organic solvents that have some of these properties, and we can get into questions on whether, you know, there would be possible to get a similar origins of life at a planet that maybe has methane instead of water, you know, hint, we can talk about that if you want to. But water does really have very specific properties when it comes to dissolve other things in it. And that is really the main, two reasons why astronomers sort of obsess about water when they're looking for planets around other stars. This is the discovery sort of image of a rather famous planetary system from the last few years. It's called TRAPPIST-1. It is indeed named after the beer, which is named after, you know, the order of the TRAPPISTs. This system became sort of made a splash because it contains seven. It's a star that's not that far away from us. It has seven planets around it. Each of these sort of dips is a planet. And three of those planets are sort of the right distance from their star where they could sustain liquid water. And why? And this is something that you can say, you know, water hospital planets is what I have called it here, called temperate planets. Most of the time, astronomers simply call them habitable planets. And they call them habitable planets because we think that water has is so important for the origins of life. Now, where these habitable planets reside does depend a lot on the star. So these seven planets in TRAPPIST-1, they are orbiting a tiny star. That's only a little bit more than 10% of what our star is like. Because of that, a temperate planet like the Earth, which is sitting at one astronomical unit from our sun, would actually be far within the orbit of Mercury in this system. So that's what's shown behind me, that you fit all these seven planets well within the orbit of Mercury. So that's just, I don't know, cool factoid, which, semi-relevant. So water, we think, okay, so it's key for life. It was probably key for the origins of life. But it's actually also really important in regulating the formation of the planet itself. So I guess I'm sort of trying to step back, that is like, however we're thinking about our origins, water plays a role. Before there was planets, there was a dusty and gaseous disk of material around our star from which planets emerged from. So the first few million years of our sun, it was still had some sort of remnant of the nebular material that formed on, swirling around it. This dust and gas is what eventually coalesced us to form planets within a few million years of the sun forming. Now, what kind of planet you form depends on whether you're forming close enough to the star where water has sublimated into the gas phase, or whether you form a little bit further out where it's cold enough for the water that is around to stick to grains, to this dust. You will, if you're inside, you'll form something like our Earth. If you're outside of this what we call snow line, you'll probably form something like Jupiter. So water has a dramatic impact on what kind of planets you form in the sort of very early stages of solar systems coming together. And it's shown, I mean, quite dramatically in our solar system, if we look at what kind of planets we have. Close to the sun, we have these small rocky planets. And then you get this giant shift in planet formation. You go from having a Mars to a Jupiter, which is, you know, a gas giant rather than a small rocky planet. So water is important. So we want to understand water just from a point of view of understanding how we fit into the universe. So keep that in the back of your mind as I want to switch over now and talk about sort of what is water, how can we generalize what water is when thinking about chemistry and chemicals and chemical reactions in general. And I don't know, when we think about chemistry, like I try to come up with some good definition. What is actually chemistry? How should we think about it in a modern way? Combination of Google and Wikipedia is what gave me this. I think it's reasonable. I mean, it's like, you know, when we think about chemistry, what you think about is how molecules interact with other molecules, with atoms, with their environment, what their compositions are, their structures, and how those things are related. So how their structure, what they're made of, how they interact, their other properties, how they all relate to one another, and how they change through interactions with their environment and other molecules. Now, it's important to keep in mind that when we're thinking about chemistry, we have sort of three different levels of complexity that we need to think about at the same time. So the lowest level is where you know, is it the breaking point between physics and chemistry, which is that of atoms. So atoms, I mean, are the, so in the modern sense, these are our substances, they are our elements. I have here oxygen as an example. We think about an atom, I mean, this is a sort of a solar system view of an atom. It's one of the early images that emerged in modern physics, where you have the positive nucleus, and then you have some orbits of electrons around it. This is a useful way of thinking about it. It is not reality. You do have some probability distribution of electrons around the nucleus. It's a better way to sort of imagine what's going on. When these atoms combine, at least two of them combine, you have a molecule. And water is going to be the molecule we focus on, which, you know, is one oxygen and two hydrogen. Now, you will, as we'll see, you get very different properties going from the atoms to the molecules. But you get, I would say, an equal difference in properties when you go from a single molecule to sort of a bulk substance. So when we think about water, we do not think about what actual properties of individual water molecules. We think about how water molecules in bulk act together. So we're going to have to think about both sort of the difference between atoms and molecules and molecules and bulk, on the other hand. Okay, so water. So what is water? So water is, you know, all darn it, it's H2O. You know, it's two hydrogen atoms, one oxygen atom. However, if we look at what the properties of water is compared to sort of the easiest way to think about its constituents, so just putting two hydrogen atoms together to form a hydrogen molecule, or two oxygen atoms together to form an oxygen molecule, we see that these properties are extremely different. Typically, the first thing you look at when you look at a substance, the easiest thing, is something like boiling temperature, melting temperature. We all know what it means, and they're sort of easy to measure. And if we compare those numbers for these three, like water, hydrogen, and oxygen, I put it in centigrade, Celsius, I hope that's okay. Anyway, there are big differences in these numbers, right? Something like molecular hydrogen only goes into solid very close to absolute zero, while water, of course, we're used to being a liquid here. So it cannot be that we can, that there's, it's not, water and its properties, the properties of the water molecule does depend on its constituents, on that it has the properties it has because it's made of hydrogen and oxygen. But it is not, in a sort of a simplistic way, cannot in a simplistic way be reduced to the properties of its constituents. And that is important to keep in mind. So instead, a better way to thinking about what water is not just that it's, you know, two hydrogen atoms, an oxygen atom, but it is hydrogen and oxygen binding together. And what gives water its properties, or at least the water molecule its properties, depends on these bonding interactions. And this is, I think, a good time to just remind ourselves what the chemical bond is. So a chemical bond, they come in a few different flavors, but the ones we will be concerned about, the ones that happens inside of water molecules, they are the sharing of electrons. So in the atoms, you know, you have this electron probability distribution, or you can think about these electron orbitals around the nucleus. If you bring something like hydrogen and oxygen together, if they bond, they're going to start sharing some of those electrons in a very specific ways. So the electrons are what glues things together. And these electrons can be shared in different ways, and that is what defines many of the properties of the molecules. And we'll look at that in more detail in a moment. But when we're talking about the water, as I said, we're not necessarily talking just about a single molecule. That is not what you typically mean when you say, what are the properties of water? You're thinking about what's in the, you know, the glass of water, right? I mean, that's a normal thing to think about. And water in bulk acts very differently from water as a single molecule. If you look at how much energy you need to sort of pull two water molecules apart, that is much, much, much lower than the energy it takes to boil a water molecule out of a bulk water. Maybe contrary to think about things like surface tension, like what, you know, what allows, you know, mosquitoes to walk on the water. You can't think about that even if you have a single molecule. If we're thinking about, you know, we'll go back to origins of life, that water can dissolve other species very easily. It can't. If you have some salt and you pour it into water, you'll dissolve that salt in the water because water molecules will start sort of surrounding the different parts of the salt. In this case, sodium and chloride ions. If you have an individual water molecule and you put it next to an individual sodium chloride molecule, nothing will happen. So this is really a property of the bulk of water, it's being able to dissolve things, not a property of the individual molecule. So to sum up this, you know, the properties of a molecule like water, it cannot be just reduced to its atomic, the properties of its atomic constituents. And the properties of the bulk water cannot be simply reduced to the properties of sort of adding up the properties of many water molecules. But in both cases, the properties of this sort of higher level of organization depends on the properties of what came before it. So when we're trying to predict the properties of bulk water, we're going to be looking at water molecules, what they're like. And similarly, when we're trying to predict the properties of water molecules, we're going to be looking at the properties of atoms. But I do want to sort of already here mention, like, I think an important thing, which is that even with all our understanding of quantum mechanics, all the supercomputers that exist, we cannot calculate exactly the properties of a water molecule. This is something we can make approximations that are very good, but there is not an exact computation of one from the other, which means that we cannot prove that chemistry can be reduced to physics. Just sort of put that out there. When we try to compute water bulk properties from water molecules, this is a much bigger computation. You have to make more approximations, and it becomes even more obvious that you cannot just feed the numbers, you know, into a computer and get the right answer out. We'll come back to that. Okay, so water. Then I said that chemical bonds is what defines what water is. Both, as we'll see, both what the water molecule is, and as it turns out, also what water as a bulk is. So a chemical bond happens because when you bring two atoms together, there's a combination of repulsive and attractive forces. So the negative, you know, cloud of one of the atoms and the positive nucleus will feel an attractive force, while the electron clouds will repulse one another and the nuclei will repulse one another. When you are far away, of course, you don't feel any of the forces. If you try to get very close, the repulsive one will take over. But somewhere in between, there is an energy minimum where when you're sharing the electrons, but still not getting, the nuclei are not getting too close to one another. And this energy minimum is the chemical bond. So what this means is that when you form a chemical bond, you get into a lower energy state compared to if the two atoms are far away from one another. So you gain energy that you somehow have to get rid of when you form the chemical bond. The nature of this chemical bond will then depend on what kind of interactions you can have between molecules. So if you have two atoms, like two hydrogen atoms, coming together and forming a hydrogen molecule, you will get your overall molecule will have no dipole. There will be no positive negative charge in it because you have, you know, two identical atoms. They both like sharing the electrons exactly the same way. So what you're left with is this neutral, like, you know, completely neutral molecule. Now, the way, though, that molecules interact with one another is through electrostatic interactions. So that you have, you know, a positive charge and a negative charge. That's how all sort of molecule-to-molecule interactions happen. That's why when you have something binding together in a liquid, instead of just being free in the gas, it's because of these electrostatic interactions. Something like two hydrogen molecules will not have strong electrostatic interactions because they are neutral. However, there is this very weak electrostatic interaction you can have in between neutral molecules. It's called van der Waals interactions. What basically happens is that you have, you know, molecule, hydrogen molecule 1, you have a small fluctuation. Remember that these electrons are a probability distribution, so you get a small fluctuation in molecule 1. And that small fluctuation gives you, let's say, a small positive charge and a small negative charge distributed over the molecule. Then the hydrogen molecule sitting next to it will feel that positive charge from the other molecule, and therefore it will move some of its electron clouds a little bit closer to the other molecule, and that sort of induced charge in both molecules will lead to a weak interaction. But that's a very weak interaction. That's why hydrogen molecules, you need to get close to absolute zero before they actually can stick together as a solid. But most molecules are not like that. Most molecules consist of at least two atoms that are different. And all atoms of different kinds have different electron affinities. That is, they will attract electrons with different strengths. So if you bring together, for example, an oxygen and a hydrogen, the oxygen will attract electrons much more strongly than hydrogen, which means that the whole electron cloud will be more over on the oxygen atom than the hydrogen atom. And this goes, it's not just oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, hydrogen, carbon and hydrogen. Like whenever you have two atoms, you will shift the electron cloud in one way or another. And this gives you a permanent dipole, which gives you then a much stronger interaction between molecules. And therefore, you can heat up the species to a much higher temperature before it all boils off into the atmosphere. The strongest kind of polar bonds that we know of are so-called hydrogen bonds. So these hydrogen is sort of special in that it is really bad at holding on to its electrons. And therefore, if it is binding to something like oxygen, you will really shift the electrons towards the oxygen side. So you will form a very strong dipole that then can have very strong interactions with other dipole molecules around it. This is called hydrogen bonding. It's a sort of special class of bonds between molecules that have this oxygen and hydrogen, or fluorine and hydrogen, like basically hydrogen plus another atom that really likes electrons. Now, the strength of these hydrogen bonds is what makes water be liquid here at room temperature. Without this, water would be a gas. It's a small molecule. You know, it would not stick to well together if you did not have these strong hydrogen bonds. These hydrogen bonds are active both in a liquid and a solid. The difference between a liquid and a solid is in a solid, you have the molecules stuck in sort of ideal positions to maximize the number of hydrogen bonds that you have. While in a liquid, you have continuously sort of forming and reforming hydrogen bonds. And it's actually quite important that these hydrogen bonds, they're in strength, they are lower than that of internal bonds in molecules, so that you can break them at room temperature. This is something that biology uses a lot, that they are sort of this intermediate strength. So they can be broken and reformed at room temperature. That is the important part of their function. Now, what's shown here is sort of that you have, you know, intact water molecules, and then you have these interactions between molecules. But what makes hydrogen bonds so strong is that the real picture is something closer to this, where the hydrogen that belongs to molecule A is actually almost binding like to molecule B as well, that you're almost sharing these hydrogen atoms between the different molecules. This is really an intermediate bond between the normal molecule-to-molecular interactions and the interactions that you have within molecules. This is what gives water many of its properties. Now, we can predict, based on the atoms, that this should happen to some extent. As I said, something like oxygen, we can calculate that it should have a high electronegativity, like a high electron affinity. It should attract electrons very strongly. Though I should say, we cannot actually predict the quantitative number that needs to be measured. I mean, quantum mechanics is awesome, but these are difficult calculations to make, even for the oxygen atom. But we can predict, at least qualitatively, that the oxygen atom should attract electrons much, much more strongly than hydrogen, the hydrogen atom. We can also say that as you go across the periodic table, the electron affinity should change in a way that's predictable. So if you look, if it goes from carbon to nitrogen to oxygen to fluorine, the electro affinity of the atom, so carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, will increase. So it means you'll form a more and more polar bond between hydrogen and that atom. You might think then that you should form a substance, a bulk substance, that has a higher and higher boiling point. So that all this was about, you know, how strongly can the molecules interact in bulk. But as listed here, that is not the case. You go from carbon to nitrogen to oxygen, nicely increases, as you might predict, though there are some other things going on as well. But then you come to hydrogen fluoride, and it drops back down. And I think this is like one of many examples where sort of you think in chemistry that you're going to have this like nice physics-like law of nature that's going to simply, you know, you're going to be able to simply apply. I would say it's a general feature of chemistry that you have patterns and rules rather than laws that always hold. And this is certainly one example where it turns out that it's not just the strength of the hydrogen bond, but also the geometry of the molecule that affects how strong hydrogen bonds you form. Reading up for this talk on water, I learned that one of the things that allow for water to bind so strongly together is the specific geometry of the water molecule. It has this sort of V shape, which allow each water molecule to bind with 3 to 4 other water molecules. And that is that sort of multiple hydrogen bond interaction that gives the substance as a bulk its very special properties. And I mean, many of these special properties are things that, you know, you have seen probably at least as a child you thought were weird or remarked upon. I mean, things being able to walk on water. I mean, it's pretty cool that at least insects can do it also in a natural way. The floating of icebergs, right? I mean, that's something that we learned early on that's weird. I mean, most substances, all except for water, they become heavier as you get to solid versus the liquid. How easy things dissolve in water, the very high boiling point of water. This all comes down to this very strong hydrogen bond interaction that it forms. And there are actually like whole books and conferences like written on water trying to predict why this is, from sort of the calculating it from understanding of molecular and atomic physics. So as I said, one of the recent results is just how sensitive the strength of the hydrogen bonding network in a solid or solution is on the exact geometry of the water molecule itself. So to sum up this, the properties of molecules, I mean, this is somewhat a repetition, but the properties of molecules, they do depend on, you know, the atoms, they do depend on how they interact. But it's not trivial to predict one from the other. And the way that science has progressed, if you just look at it from sort of a empirical point of view, it is rarely that it's gone from just computing, you know what the atoms are doing, you compute it, you know, up to the next level, to molecules and then to bulk. Rather, it is that you do experiments on the bulk and on the molecules, you find these properties, and then you try to fit your original equations. Like, you basically fill in, you know, the numbers, the quantitative part of your equations. I mean, that's how these discoveries have been made, and it's how they continue to be made, rather than calculating things from first principles. Rather, the sort of first principles calculations are mostly used to try to understand what you already know to be true. And that's where a lot of this comes in. Okay, so chemical reactions, or the final component before I get to talk about the history of water. So this is, you know, a movie of a typical chemical interaction. You have an attacking atom coming in, and you break apart the old molecule, form new species. The way we think about a chemical reaction, so how you change from one molecule to another, is something like this. So we think about it in sort of energy diagrams. is the way that they're typically conceived. So you have your reactants. They have some relative energy that depends on the strength of their bonds, basically. You try to put them together. As you try to put them together, you have to start distorting and sort of breaking chemical bonds. That costs energy, so you're going to have this energy bump. But then as your product form, you're sort of reconstituting bonds in a more in a more energetically favorable way, and you drop down into sort of a low energy potential. Whether the reactants or the products have the sort of the lower energy can vary, but this is the overall thing what happens. In the case of water, trying to break water into its constituents and form sort of molecular hydrogen and molecular oxygen costs energy. So it means that it's actually favorable for, if you have a lot of oxygen and hydrogen around, it is favorable to move those into water. It's energetically favorable. But it doesn't necessarily happen if you have at room temperature molecular hydrogen and molecular oxygen, they're not spontaneously going to react. If you get a small spark, they might react, and they might react very forcefully, and that is why we no longer fly around hydrogen balloons. But just having them here at room temperature is not going to make them react, and that's because of these energy bumps. Now, there are two, like when we try to predict which way chemical reaction will go, there are basically two things we need to take into account. One is the height of this energy that it takes to, these energy bumps that you need to get over to get into the product state. And the other is the relative energy of the different products. So I'm showing here sort of you have your initial reactants are these, you know, very prosaic A, B, and C, D. Those are your reactants. And you can imagine you can recombine these into a number of different ways. So I've had them into A, D, and B, C, and into that should have been something else than A, D, and B, C. Like, let's pretend it's like, I don't know, A, D, B, C or something. It's a bigger molecule. Remove the plus sign. I will correct that. But anyway, you have two different set of products most of the time that you can form. And which one you will form depends on how hot it is, basically. If it is very hot, so these energy bumps are easy to get over, think about a very fast rolling ball, nature will always pick going to down here, to the lowest energy state. On the other hand, if it's very cold, so it's difficult to get over this initial energy bumps, you are probably going to go in the other way, like to go over the smaller bump, even if the final state is not so energetically favorable. This is going to be important when you think about where the water here on Earth came from. Because if the water formed when everything was nice and warm, then it obviously doesn't matter what you started with, because water is really a very energetically favorable state to end up in. But if the water formed cold, we have much fewer potential pathways to get us to water because of this problem with this sort of transition state energy, and the transition state are, you know, the peaks of these bumps. So, chemical reactions. What's sort of some of the key things? Well, it's a chemical reaction. I mean, it is the forming and breaking of a chemical bond or multiple chemical bonds. Breaking a bond always costs energy. Forming a bond always gives you energy. Because breaking a bond or even distorting a bond costs energy, almost all chemical reactions involve an energy barrier that you have to get over before you can get down into the products. And the height of this barrier will depend on the details. It's impossible, again, to calculate from first principles. It's typically measured in the lab. Now, when you have multiple options for a chemical reaction, which you do most of the time, then it does depend on the temperature whether you will be able to take the path to the lowest energy state or whether you will take the path that has sort of the lowest transitional state energy. And as you can imagine, if you're out in a very cold space in between stars, a lot of the times we're going to go through that lower energy barrier pathway. And that's where I want to go next. So today we live in a universe, in a cosmos that is chemical. Obviously we have chemistry here on Earth. But also if we look between stars, so this is a spectra that's acquired towards Orion. Orion is a beautiful constellation, but it's also a cloud where stars are forming right now. This spectra just shows that there's lots of organic molecules when you look at a place like the Orion Nebula. And almost wherever we look, when we look at regions where stars and planets are currently forming, we see molecules of different kinds. So all that's shown here is six astronomical pictures of different kind of nebulae where stars and planets are currently forming. For those of you who have heard me before, you might remember that in our galaxy alone, seven new stars with planetary systems come into existence every year. We are in an actively star-forming era. And we can see where these stars and planets form. And just as we can take pictures of the structures where they form, we can take pictures of the molecules using spectroscopy. So the important thing is just that there are molecules everywhere. However, the universe was not always a chemical one. I mean, in some sense, the universe was formed with physics, right? Physics was there from the beginning, but chemistry was not. Chemistry had to emerge. And the reason chemistry had to emerge is that to have a chemical reaction, you need to first have atoms that can stick together. And when at the very dawn of our universe, it was too hot to have atoms stick together. So you only had sort of different components of atoms swirling around. But as the universe expanded, it cooled down. It cooled down within sort of a few hundred thousand years. It cooled down enough for atoms to start to stick together, for the electrons and the nucleus to stick together. Before then, it had gone through an epoch of nucleus synthesis, where some of the protons that make up hydrogen had fused together to form helium, a little bit of deuterium, and a tiny bit of lithium. But really, we are in a universe where we have mostly hydrogen and helium. So you can't have a lot of chemistry, but with hydrogen and helium atoms. But you can have some. And the very first molecule in the universe was this one, helium hydrogen plus. So this is the dawn of chemistry. And as I said, it's not that, you know, time zero, but it is within a few hundred thousand years of the universe forming, the first molecule comes into its existence. And because all bonds, you know, give you energy, when you in this case the hydrogen ion and the helium atom comes together, you form this molecule, and you release energy with a photon. So this was the very first chemical reaction in the universe. Now, to have more interesting chemistry happening, you need to have more elements around than hydrogen and helium. And those elements came with the existence of the formation and the explosions of the first stars. Among the elements that formed were basically in the stellar explosions, we formed the elements of the periodic table. One of the elements that's very easy to form is oxygen. So if we look at today, and this is actually not too different compared to if we go back, you know, billions of years, what are the most abundant elements in the universe? Well, hydrogen and helium are there because they came with a big bang. But then of the elements that form through nucleosynthesis in stars, oxygen is actually the most abundant one. So when we're thinking about what should be the most abundant molecule in the universe, I mean, water should probably be up there on your list of likely candidates, since you are combining two of the most abundant elements that exist in the universe. So you need to so chemistry emerged in these multiple steps, right? So first, you need to be cool enough to form any molecule. We have our weird H helium plus molecule. But then you need to have stars forming and dying, which takes another millions of years. The first stars were probably very short-lived. That gives you the oxygen. We think very soon after you have the oxygen, you form water. But to actually have bulk water, as the way we think about it, you need some surface for these water molecules to assemble. This can be tiny surfaces in the early universe or planets. But it is sort of this three-step emergence of chemistry as we think about it today. Okay, so the final thing that I want to talk about is then water itself. So I said we think water started forming very soon in the universe, but that is not the water that we drink from our cup today. That water, that very early water, that has been destroyed and reformed many times. Because you can imagine space between stars is pretty ruthless space, and you'll break apart any molecules pretty quickly. But where water comes from is still, we think, precedes the formation of this Earth, and we're going to try to trace it back to the formation environment of our sun. So this is a cartoon of how a star like our sun forms. So you have first an interstellar cloud. This is a dust and gas concentration in between stars. If you have seen the Orion Nebula, these beautiful astrophysical images, it's something like that. These clouds of material can become sort of heavy enough that they start falling in on themselves just due to self-gravity. As they collapse, they will always spin a little bit. Nothing in the universe is like perfectly still, so you always have a little bit of rotation or spin. As the collapse happen, you will spin up, just as a figure skater spins up when she puts her legs together. This spinning up is so fast that if it all went into the forming star, the star would fly apart. So instead, how nature solves this is that it puts most of that spin into material in a disk around the star. So we're talking about in terms of angular momentum in the solar system. I mean, almost all the mass, more than 99% of the mass in our solar system is in the sun. But more than 90% of the angular momentum is in Jupiter. So the angular momentum is really preserved in this disk of dust and gas around the star, and then this dust and gas come together to form planets. And as I already said, when we look at these different stages, from the cloud up to the planet stage, we always see molecules of different kinds. Now, the molecule that we see a lot of, and maybe you should not be surprised because I told you that oxygen and hydrogen are so common, is water. And the main way we see water is in an absorption feature that's around 3 microns in the infrared, and this is due to water ice. So water ice is one of the most abundant substances in the universe. It's only maybe 2 others that sort of are more abundant. So incredibly abundant molecule in the universe. So how, I already said this could not be just surviving all the way from the earliest universe. So how does this form? Well, the easiest way, we know we have hydrogen atoms, we have oxygen atoms coming from the stars, right? So we put them together, you get OH, we add another hydrogen atom, and you get water. Now, unfortunately, this doesn't work. And it doesn't work for what seems like a very unfair reason, which is that you form this chemical bond, you gain, like this, that's an energetically more favorable state, which is good. I mean, that's where nature likes to go. But that energy has to go somewhere. So you can think about it, if you have this potential well, you have a ball rolling down. If there's no friction, the ball will just roll out again. And that's what happens if you try to do this reaction. So all that energy that you gain from forming the bond, it can't go anywhere, so it goes back into breaking the bond. So this reaction actually doesn't happen. Even though you have all that hydrogen and oxygen around, you actually cannot form water this way. Luckily, there is another way, which is because we have a lot of tiny dust grains in the space between stars. And if you have that oxygen and hydrogen meeting on the dust grain instead, Now, energy can be absorbed by that dust grain and you form water. And that's also water, you know, sitting on the surface, that is actually water ice. That is why all the water we see is in ice form. So we know we can form water, we see it. But does it actually survive the rather violent process of forming a star? I mean, slamming material together to form a star and then to form a planet is not, I mean, it's not obvious that molecules should survive that process. But we, and actually also, how would you tell? How would you tell if the water came from, you know, outer space or if it was made here in a factory? Like, I mean, how would you tell? It's just an oxygen and two hydrogen, right? You can't label, like, a hydrogen and oxygen. Actually, you can. The way that nature labels it is by the isotopic composition of the hydrogen. So hydrogen can exist in multiple isotopic forms, and when an isotope is just the same element, which means it has the same number of electrons and protons, that's what defines an element, but it has a different number of neutrons, these neutral elemental particles in the nucleus. So if you add one neutron, you get heavy water. So you get the deuterium instead of a hydrogen. And if, or like you get heavy hydrogen. If you add that heavy hydrogen or deuterium to water, you get heavy water. Now, if everything just, if we were to form water here on Earth, if we had some, you know, reservoir of deuterium, some reservoir of hydrogen, we would just form heavy water with exactly the right proportion of deuterium and hydrogen. Their chemistry is basically identical. In the universe, we have a deuterium to hydrogen ratio, which is set by the Big Bang. It's about 2 times 10 to the minus 5. So you have 2 deuterium atoms for every 100,000 hydrogen atoms. But there are ways, when I said that the deuterium atom is basically the same as the hydrogen, the basically is important. It is the same if we're sitting here at room temperature, but if you're down close to absolute zero, so 10 Kelvin, 20 Kelvin, that deuterium atom starts acting a little bit differently compared to a hydrogen atom. It turns out that forming a chemical bond with a deuterium instead of a hydrogen is slightly stronger, only slightly. It's so slight that here at room temperature it doesn't matter. But if you're down at 10, 20 Kelvin, even slight differences start mattering. So if you're at very low temperatures, you will preferentially form water with a deuterium atom compared to a normal hydrogen atom. So if the water formed cold out in space, we would expect that it would have too much deuterium in it. There should be too much heavy water around. And so the exact chemical reaction is here, but that's less important. So what do we see with our water? Well, wherever we look in the solar system, including in our oceans, we do not see what we would expect from the Big Bang, which I said would be that you would have 2, you know, deuterium atoms per 100,000, roughly. Instead, we see that we have about 1 deuterium atom per 10,000 normal water. And that's just what's shown here. It's the D-to-H ratio. Or you can see it on the screen, it's the D-to-H ratio in water. If you forget the gray part, because that's not water, but everywhere where you have water, you have too much of the deuterium. And I said, and that includes our oceans here. So when you're drinking water, you know, every 10,000 molecule you're drinking is a heavy water, because it turns out our water came from outer space, where it was enriched in heavy water. And because all our water was basically inherited, it's not so strange that we are not the only water-rich body in the solar system, but rather it is common across the solar system, including there are oceans in some of the moons in the outer solar system, and so on. And even what today are dry planets were probably once wet planets. We think that Mars and Venus had a lot of water, just as the Earth did, because it was basically all inherited as part of the planet formation process. And it was sort of later losses that led to them being dry. Okay, so lots of text here, but to sum up, so what can we say about water in particular, and then, you know, more chemistry more generally? Well, so to go back to the beginning, when we're trying to get to the properties of molecules, they do depend on the properties of the atoms that are their constituents, because the properties of the atoms determine how the atoms can bind together to form these molecules. However, calculating from first principles how these atoms are going to bind together is for sure beyond what we can do today, and it might actually not. Let's say it's not even theoretically possible to do it exactly. We're always going to have to do approximations. And that probably explains why just the way that chemistry or understanding of chemistry has emerged has been driven by experiments with calculations providing explanations for why the experiments work the way they do. It's also important to realize that the properties of molecules and the properties of bulk substances are not the same thing. And again, the properties of bulk substances certainly depend on the properties of their constituents, since that determines how the molecules can have these weaker interactions or bonds between them. But again, this is something that people are still trying to figure out exactly what that dependence is. Chemistry is not something that's always been around. It's something that emerges as the universe evolves through a combination of basically the expansion of the universe and of stars forming and exploding and creating the elements that makes up the more interesting chemistry we have. And I would say it's one of these wonderfully providential things that oxygen just happens to be one of the most abundant atoms in the universe, considering the very specific properties that you get from when oxygen combines with the most abundant element in the universe, water. And finally, when we think about where our water came from, it is something that actually was there before the Earth formed, that this too is sort of a historic process, that where water forms and are preserved as a part of stars and planets coming together. And with that, I'm only, according to my timer, 7 minutes over time, and I'm happy to take questions.
Well, thank you so much. So we have a couple, time for a couple of questions, so starting back there.
Thank you very much. Question about this very strange thing about how the individual water molecule, right, is lacking properties that bulk water has, right, they're commonly associated with. Would this entail perhaps that these are actually two different substances, the mystic term substance? Is my question here. Like bulk water with these certain properties that don't seem to be present in the individual water molecule. You actually have two things that we happen to call water, but actually two different substances.
So I'm going to defer that question to the next talk, which will be someone who has a better understanding of Thomistic and Aristotelian philosophy. I mean, my gut reaction would be no, and that this is where I think we need to think about how to sort of map one to the other, because it is sort of it's both a continuum and then some things that really require the bulk. If you have five water molecules, you can dissolve an ion. But you're not going to have surface tension the way that we understand it with five water molecules. So there is sort of more things that emerges as you bring more and more molecules together. But I think it's a really interesting question, and I look forward to sort of a better informed answer by someone else.
So I'm going to take a little bit to follow up on that. So in nature, so we're familiar with water on Earth. I mean, how often do we, like the water you say is so abundant in the universe, how much of that is what we kind of call bulk water, that you have, you know, several hundred molecules sitting together, and how much of it is individual molecules isolated?
Most of it is bulk, but it's bulk in a way that we are not used to seeing here on Earth. So we call it an ice, so water ice you're all familiar with. And it is sort of in an icy layer on these small grains. That's where most of the water resides. However, it is not in an ordered ice, like a crystalline ice like we have here. It is some sort of frozen liquid is the way to think about it, an amorphous ice. But that is the main way that water exists in the universe today.
Okay.
Dr. Ober, thank you so much. I want to invite you to flex your theological muscles.
Oh, no.
So, obviously, Jesus says that he's offering us living water. As you're contemplating the properties of water, I'm wondering if there are maybe three points for reflection that you could offer to us that are reflecting something more supernatural.
Oh, no. All this is being recorded. Thank you. No, I mean, I think this is a beautiful question. And as I was hinting at towards the end, I mean, it is one of these, you know, beautiful providential things where where our needs and what the cosmos is providing as a whole sort of fits together perfectly. I mean, there's something extravagant about the water being, I said, the third most abundant molecule in the universe. I mean, the amount of water that is around is intense. And then at the same time, it is this, like, you know, tiny little molecule that allows for us to live and to, you know, be fulfilled in so many ways. That to me, again, it's like, there's so many things when you look in, I think, into astronomy, where the sort of extravagance of creation becomes apparent. Now, there might be that there are many other living things that this water was also created for, but even if it wasn't, I mean, there's a beauty in that extravagance. When it comes to sort of going more down here on Earth, what to say? Do I have any sort of deeper theological things to say that can be useful? I don't know. I'm gonna have to think about it. Like, let me see if something comes up, and then when we come back to the panel discussions, because I do think it's a beautiful question, but I hadn't really thought ahead about it.
Yeah. So you mentioned at some point that the properties of water are like H2O, I guess, are irreducible to the properties of H2O and O2. You also said that the properties of H2O and O2 actually determine some aspects of that property of H2O. Can you elaborate more on the part, like what properties of H2O and O2 are determined?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I should. So I guess the first thing is to say that I use H2 and O2 as comparisons to water because if you look at the individual atoms, they're so reactive that you can't actually say what their boiling or melting point is in a sort of the way that we're used to thinking about it. So it's really the properties of the individual atoms that matters for water rather than the H2 molecule or O2 molecule. So what matters there is that their electroaffinity. That's what determines the kind of bond that they can form together. That's one of them. Now you can ask, so what does the electroaffinity depend on in sort of when you look at the atomic properties? And that depends on basically the size of the nucleus, or like how much charge you have in the nucleus versus the how far the bonding electrons are from the nucleus. So you can imagine if you have a nucleus that has a lot of charge and the bonding sort of electrons are pretty close to it, it's going to want to pull, in some sense, the electrons closer to it. So oxygen is a good example. It has 8 times as much positive charge than hydrogen, so it's going to want to pull electrons much more stronger than hydrogen does, by, you know, 8 times. And its electron cloud is not that much farther away from the nucleus compared to hydrogen, which is why it really does pull these bonding electrons much more efficiently to it. So that's so qualitatively we can say that, but as I sort of alluded to, we can't actually calculate what the exact electroaffinity of different atoms should be. That's something that's measured experimentally. So it's one more example where I think physics does provide some explanation, but it doesn't actually provide a prediction. So it doesn't have that predictive capability in chemistry that we're used to thinking as sort of a very important part of a natural law, and I think that's where some of the tension between physics and chemistry comes in.
All right, maybe time for one more question. We do have a larger discussion session in the afternoon as well.
So, yeah. Just realized I didn't understand this. If water forms on these interstellar grains,
yeah,
how do we get so much of it inside the snow line?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm going to repeat it or like slightly reformulate because our planet formed inside of the water snow line, which means that we formed in a place where there was actually no water ice on the grains because it had all sublimated into the gas phase. And I was totally glossing over that. So we probably formed pretty dry actually. But part of how our solar system came together was that there was a lot of collisions between the Earth and other bodies flying around as the Earth was coming together. And many of those came from outside of the snow line. So if you look at today's asteroids and comets, they mostly formed outside of the snow line. They have a lot of what asteroids used to have, probably a lot more ice than they do today. Comets still maintain their ice. So it was probably mostly impacts with that. There is, however, another sort of possible explanation, which is that we don't actually have that much water if you compare it to the bulk of the Earth. So it might have been enough that just a little bit of water sort of seeped into the cracks of these tiny grains, forming basically a water mineral that can then seep back out. So it's probably both, that you have some of this water just got stuck in these rather dry grains. And some that came through later delivery. If we look at the sort of how much water we have here on Earth, it's on sort of the percent level compared to the bulk of the Earth. If you look at the comet, it's 50%. So we are not very water rich in that sense.
All right, let's thank Dr. Ogre one more time.